Hello and welcome to our sleep disorders presentation. I'm excited to share this information about all the different things that can go wrong with sleep. You know, we think about all of our patients and our clients and how important sleep is. And by now, hopefully you have a really good understanding of why sleep is so important. Then we're going to look at, well, what goes wrong? Like there's insomnia, there's narcolepsy, there's so many different things. So what can go wrong? What causes them? And then we'll have a whole section on what to do about it. So again, before I begin, I want to make sure that you're aware that everything that I'm sharing with you is not medical advice. It's just information from my decades of experience and my research to you. And the same when you share this information with your clients, just make sure that they're aware that it's all education and it's in the spirit of helping them to become more balanced. And that if they're working with a doctor, they have to make sure that anything that you share, they run by their doctor. And the same thing goes for you. Anything I share, run it by your doctor to make sure. So we've talked about deep sleep. We've talked about the importance of sleep. We've talked about the hormones in the sleep. We've talked about the impact of poor sleep on hormone balance as well as a brain balance, etc. So what are some of the things that impact getting a good night's sleep? One is shift work. Studies that have been done on shift work showed an associated shorter life expectancy when people are on shift work. So they've done nurses studies, a bunch of different nurses studies. If you want to look any of these up, there's lots of research. It's hard to get enough of the deep sleep when they're in that state of fluctuation, especially shift workers who then on the weekend go back to the regular person's schedule and then they go back to it. Their body never really deals with it. And most people who are doing shift work rarely get more than 4 to 6 hours good solid sleep a night. What else impacts it? Well, we've talked about this before. Eating late at night, it interferes with the quality of the sleep. It interferes with the growth and the repair and the detoxification that happens during the night. And you may find people complaining that when they eat late at night, they feel groggy in the morning. And when they follow your advice to not eat so late at night, then they feel much more alert in the morning. TV and computer right before bed. We've talked about that. The bright light going in through the retina will cause an interference with the melatonin, less melatonin to be produced. Worry. Like, okay, if somebody's in this state of worry, they just can't get into the deeper stages of sleep as quickly as you need to get a really good quality of sleep. So when people are laying there and the mind is racing and thinking about all the things they need to do the next day and all the things they didn't get done today and all this stuff, it's like, oh, it's just not the right. It's just not conducive. And I know this happens every now and then. This happens to me where I get so much on my mind and I get in bed and I just can't get it shut off. Typically what I'll do is I'll get up, I'll take out a paper, I'll write everything that's running through my mind down on the piece of paper. I lay back down, I do some heart math, and if that doesn't do the trick, then I take some passion flower. And we'll talk about a lot of the things that you can do to support people when these things happen. And then, of course, alcohol, caffeine, sugar, and certain medications can interfere with the quality of sleep. We've talked about the impact of the food and sugar and insulin and all that. But some of the medications that might get in the way are antihistamines, Ritalin, cold medication, steroids, headache medication with caffeine, and energy drinks. So you want to really look when you're doing a thorough history to see, is your client taking any of these things? That might be related to why they're having so much trouble sleeping. So let's take a look at what some of those things, the common sleep disorders, and we'll go into these in a little bit more detail. Well, there's 84 classifications of sleeping disorders. We are not going to go into all 84 classifications of sleep disorders. If that's something you want to do, you're welcome to do it on your own. If you want to become the sleep expert, that's fine. But I'm going to go into the main ones that you might see in your clinical practice. So insomnia, right, the inability to fall asleep or the inability to stay asleep once you wake up in the middle of the night or waking up frequently. Narcolepsy, which is the falling asleep during the day. Sleep apnea, which is when difficulty breathing during the night, which keeps waking you up. You wake up because you can't get the breath. Restless leg syndrome, you know, it's not actually a sleep disorder per se, but it interferes with sleep. Night terrors. We see that more in children than adults, but some adults have night terrors where it's more than just a bad dream. It's like this waking up in this completely anxious state and just unable to control it. And if you've ever seen a kid in night terrors, I think one of my kids had a night terror once, and it was just like you can't calm them down. They're just like convulsing with just fear and anxiety, and it's really difficult to realize that they're no longer in the dream, even when they're sitting there awake. And then sleepwalking, that can be a dangerous one. I remember somebody telling me, I was doing really great with the diet, and I have been losing weight. I lost like 40 pounds, and then all of a sudden I plateaued. And then I started going into the kitchen in the morning and seeing like food remnants on the counter. And I wonder, can I be sleepwalking and eating in my sleep? We never did figure it out, whether it was her or her partner, but it certainly is a possibility. So let's look at the prevalence of sleep disorders. Over 2 million children suffer from sleep disorders. That's huge. Why are our children suffering from sleep disorders? Well, a lot of the reasons are the reasons that we teach people to overcome to restore balance, right? Their nutrient deficiencies, excesses of anti-nutrients, lots of stress, lots of TV, lots of video games, and not a lot of relaxed time being pushed. 30 to 40% of the children actually don't sleep enough. That's a huge percentage, 30 to 40%. I know when my kids were little, when they were very little, they needed 12 to 13 hours a night of sleep. But even all through elementary school, I found that they needed that 11 to 12 hours of sleep. And if the kids are being pushed and out late and they have homework, as they got older and had to do their homework, they started to get sleep deprived as they were going into middle school and high school. Because even though they still needed all that sleep, the schedule of being at school for 8 hours a day and then coming home and maybe doing some sport and then having to do 3, 4 hours of homework was really stressful. So our kids are stressed to the max and they're not sleeping properly. This is difficulty that women, this is interesting, I mean, women are twice as likely as men to have hard time falling and staying asleep. Maybe because women tend to be the worriers. Maybe they tend to because they tend to be the protectors of their family. But that's statistically shown. Pregnancy can worsen sleep patterns. And some of this is because it's hard to get comfortable. You get this big watermelon out of your belly. Your kid is kicking, causing pressure against the stomach. There's a lot of reasons that could do that. Menopause and hormone changes cause changes in sleep. And we talked about the effects of the estrogen and progesterone and testosterone and how important they are to have good levels in order to be able to get good sleep. So it's actually estimated that over half of people over the age of 65 experience disturbed sleep. So you're going to see a lot of these people coming through your door, and they may not be associating the problems they're having to their lack of sleep. They're just coming in and telling you, I'm exhausted. I've got these joint pains. My doctor said I'm pre-diabetic and I want to change that. But they're not like really getting there. So you really have to ask the right questions to get to the point of knowing there's a sleep issue. And so many times, people are looking for that needle in the haystack, right? Somebody's exhausted. Well, oh, well, is it their thyroid? Is it their adrenals? Is it some inflammatory thing? And you're looking for all these reasons they're exhausted. And you really have to stop and say, how much sleep are they getting? And most people are not getting enough sleep. They're just not. And when you can help them to get more sleep, it's going to completely profoundly change their health. So let's look at some of these disorders. Insomnia. The Mayo Clinic reports that insomnia is one of the most commonly reported medical complaints that doctors receive. And I will attest to that. I see so many people that may not be complaining about insomnia as their main thing, but a lot of them are. But there's so many of them that have it, and they don't even relate it to some of their other issues. More than a third of adults are estimated to have suffered from or will suffer from during their lifetimes some form of insomnia, some state of insomnia, or period of insomnia. So, how do you know whether somebody's in an insomniac? Well, they have difficulty falling asleep, staying asleep, or they have a non-restorative sleep. So that sleep that's kind of they're restless, they're tossing, they're turning, that's insomnia as well, even though they're perceived as being asleep. They have difficulty the difficulty presents despite adequate opportunity and circumstance to sleep. And this is a critical one because a lot of people aren't giving themselves the opportunity to sleep. What does that mean? They're not actually getting into bed. you have to go to bed. So if someone has enough time, right, they're not on a schedule where they're critical and they only get 6 hours that they could possibly sleep, it's the decrease in sleep and the difficulty falling asleep and staying asleep when they actually have that opportunity. And that's big. It's huge. The sleep impairment is associated with daytime impairment or distress. So that exhaustion, that falling asleep on the job, that not being able to focus, brain fog, all of this can be coming from insomnia. So it's really, really important. It's defined as having occurring at least 3 times a week and has been a problem for at least a month. So if somebody has this temporary thing, you know, they have a week of extra work and extra stress and, you know, things are happening and can't fall asleep and it's happening for a week, even if it's every night, but then they go back to normal or it happens for a couple of weeks, then that's not considered insomnia. That's temporary insomnia, but that diagnostic criteria, like if they were going to go to the doctor and have to, you know, pick out the diagnostic code, that they would not be able to use that if that doesn't meet that criteria. But it's that chronic state that over and over, it's at least 3 nights a week or more, and they just can't fall asleep, and it's been going on for over a month, then you can classify them as having insomnia. And there's a good study on that. So what causes insomnia? Well, a lot of the things we've already talked about, right? Stress. You just can't fall asleep. The cortisol's raging. There's a lot of stuff going on. You're spending so much time in the sympathetic dominant nervous system. And you can't sleep when you're in sympathetic dominance. You have to transition to parasympathetic in order to be able to fall asleep. And people who are in a stage one of adrenal dysfunction, they just can't do it. People who have adrenal fatigue, or better word might be adrenal dysfunction, where they have peaks and valleys and they have high spikes of cortisol and then super low spikes of cortisol, they have possibly causing insomnia. Hypothyroidism, people who have low thyroid function oftentimes have difficulty falling asleep, which is, you know, it's kind of paradoxical because they're exhausted because of the hypothyroid and other features, but they just can't fall asleep. The paradox is also the people who are hyperthyroid, who are overexcited, they get exhausted at bedtime because they've used so much energy. And they can have problems falling asleep, but they're not as likely to have insomnia, statistically speaking, as people who are hypothyroid. Hypoglycemia, but I would go even further, but any kind of blood sugar dysregulation, super important. You know, whenever there's the insulin spikes, high levels of insulin makes it difficult for people to fall asleep because it interferes with the growth hormone, which helps somebody to fall asleep. Parasites. A lot of people lay awake at night because parasites typically lay their eggs at night. And so folks who are have parasites tend to stay up at night because these parasites start laying eggs and being active and keeping them awake. Maybe they have itching in you know, in their anal area or whatever, but that can be a problem. Overstimulation. Well, that's like most of people, right? Overstimulation, right? Watching TV, watching the news, getting agitated about all the bad things happening in the world, having all that light coming into your eyes, watching TV, all of that. In pregnancy, you know, we talked about that before. There's a lot of reasons for that. And then nicotine, caffeine, and alcohol can contribute to insomnia. So it really goes back to doing a really thorough history to figure out what are the underlying causes for your particular person. So let's look at narcolepsy. Narcolepsy is excessive daytime sleepiness. And it's not just, oh, I feel like I want to fall asleep in the middle of the day. It's falling asleep. Falling asleep sitting at a chair, falling asleep sitting at the dinner table, falling asleep at work, falling asleep watching TV. I don't know that that's necessarily narcolepsy because people are usually exhausted and they should be in bed by the time they sit in front of the TV. My father-in-law used to do that. My husband still does. He just sits down on the couch and the next thing you know, he's asleep. And it's mainly because it's late and he should be in bed. So that's not narcolepsy. But narcolepsy is that, you know, this person, you walk in the office and they're sitting there sleeping or they're driving. That's really problematic, right? A kind of a thing that goes along with narcolepsy is cataplexy. And that's the sudden loss of muscle function that comes on by strong emotions or laughter. And it's just like, it's almost like you think they're asleep. You think they're going into a coma or having a seizure, but they suddenly, well, not seizures because it's extra, but they're just like, they lose it. Sudden loss of muscle function because they start to laugh. You know, that's an issue. Sleep paralysis. A normal amount of sleep paralysis is normal during certain phases of it, like during the deep rapid eye movement sleep, that there's paralysis of all the muscles. And that's why, like, a lot of times you're feeling like you're in a dream and you want to fight, but you just can't move and you can't get out of the dream because you can't move your body. That's normal. But sleep paralysis, where the person falls asleep during the day and then they can't move. Sudden sleep attacks, you know, like I said, at different points in time. And then dreamlike hallucinations. So maybe you're sitting in, it's beyond daydreaming, which is like, oh, I think I want to go to the beach. Let me pretend I'm at the beach. Oh, I'm loving it. But it's more like a hallucination, like in the middle of the day, and they're suddenly starting to see things happening. So that's all the definitions of narcolepsy. So what are some of the things that can cause narcolepsy? Well, there's a brain chemical called hypocretin, also known as orexin. And when we don't have enough of that, the immune system gets involved. So, well, let me take it back. When people don't have enough of it, it's kind of because the immune system just mistakenly attacks the part of the brain that produces it. So that's kind of, and it's an autoimmune condition which attacks that. That's one thing. In 2012, scientists in Switzerland discovered that some people with narcolepsy also produce antibodies against a protein called TRIB2. And TRIB2 is produced in an area that also produces the hypocretin. And it's that lack of hypocretin that causes the brain to be less able to regulate the cycles. So not being able to, like, the melatonin may not be as effective because melatonin is low during the day, usually, but it's the person sleeping. So it's less able to regulate the normal cycles of wake and sleep when there's not enough hypocretin, or orexin is also the name of it. So who's at risk? Well, gene variants. So a gene variant called DQB1-0602. These people are found to have more of a narcolepsy tendency. So you can see our fellow in the picture, you know, he's fallen asleep. He's sitting there in his suit with his head asleep in his cereal bowl. It's just like totally, you can't control it. It's not like you go, oh, I'm starting to go to sleep. No, it's just like, boom, you're asleep. Hormonal changes, including those that happen at puberty and menopause. So the kids going into puberty and women going into menopause are more likely to have a risk for narcolepsy, given that they have that gene variant as well. Psychological stress, like really traumatic psychological stress. Sudden changes in sleep patterns, that has been shown to contribute. Not like everybody is like suddenly they are in a different country and they have to do it, although if they have a tendency towards it and the other things are right, we get a perfect storm that could create it. A certain infection, swine flu and strep infections have been associated with it, but also the flu vaccine. And there's a particular one called Pandemrix that I found that is actually associated with it. But vaccines and specific flu infections can increase the risks for narcolepsy. And let's just look quickly at narcolepsy statistics so we know how often are we going to see this. It affects as many as 200,000 Americans, which is significant. Fewer than 50% are 50,000 are diagnosed, so that's a quarter. So maybe, you know that, yeah, a quarter of them. Fewer than 25% are actually diagnosed with this. And you can see our guy falling asleep at the thing. But a lot of people ignore it. They don't even notice that it's a problem. 8 to 12% have a close relative with the disease, which goes back to the SNP and the genetic pretendency. Men more likely than women. And 20 to 25% of people with narcolepsy actually have all four of these symptoms: excessive daytime sleepiness, sudden loss of muscle function, sleep paralysis, and hallucinations. Right? So if you've got someone who has all of those criteria, they're pretty clear that there's some narcolepsy going on. It's not like you're going to be in a situation where you're going to diagnose cases of narcolepsy, but you want to be able to look at when somebody's exhausted, you start to just ask them about situations like this. So sleep apnea. Oh, yeah, we have sleep apnea. And how many people do you know that you talk to are on a CPAP machine? That it's huge. I mean, it's almost like it's an epidemic of sleep apnea. And so sleep apnea is, there's some loud snoring, and that's usually an obstructive sleep apnea. So there's central sleep apnea and obstructive sleep apnea. But it's basically the breathing stops during sleep, and it's usually witnessed by another person. And it can be scary. And, you know, the person may stop breathing, and all of a sudden they're like, you know, they startle up. But it can be very dangerous as well. So usually it's seen like a partner is saying, well, you just stop breathing. And they're like shaking them because they're freaked out. It could be abrupt awakenings, like I just said, accompanied by shortness of breath. So they've stopped breathing during sleep, and then suddenly it's like, because they get awake because their body's signaling them, you need oxygen, wake up. Dry mouth or sore throat. So people that may not know they have sleep apnea, but you wake up all the time with that dry mouth or a sore throat. So if you're talking to somebody and they say, yeah, I wake up with such a dry mouth and a sore throat and I don't understand it, they may have sleep apnea. May have a morning headache because of the lack of oxygenation to the brain. They may just notice that it's hard to stay asleep. And some people with difficulty staying asleep is actually because of sleep apnea. Sometimes it's just, in addition, they're going to say their excessive sleepiness during the day. Well, of course, they're going to be more tired during the day because they haven't gotten the sleep at night. And some of them have attention issues and irritability. So these are all the symptoms that can be presenting. And of course, some of these symptoms are totally not related to sleep apnea, but it's up to you, you know, and just being clear with looking at what's going on with people, like are there attention problems related to neurotransmitters, to gut dysbiosis, to eating the wrong foods, to deficiencies of various nutrients, to insulin resistance or sleep apnea? So it's just one of the things to consider when folks present with some of these common symptoms. These are just pictures that show the obstruction. So there's two different types, like I said, obstructive sleep apnea and central sleep apnea. Obstructive is when the muscles in the back of the throat can relax more than normal. And so there's a pressure against the breathing, and the air does not go down into the lungs. It can happen with excessive weight or obesity, that there's more pressure against that in the closure of the tube, the breathing tube. It could be from enlarged tonsils or adenoids. That's pretty easy to spot. You may not look in people's throats, but if you do, it's really easy to spot enlarged tonsils or adenoids. Some folks who have a large overbite are more prone to obstructive sleep apnea, and people with Down syndrome are more prone to that. So whenever somebody's having difficulty with the obstructive sleep apnea, there's usually something that's obstructing, obviously, the breathing. With central sleep apnea, it's not an obstruction on a local level. It's actually that the brain doesn't transmit signals to the muscles for breathing. And you know, that's a central thing, and that's treated much differently. They may both need a breathing machine in order to deal with it, but the underlying causes are much different. This is just said, aging limits brain signals to the throat muscles to keep stiff during sleep, and so the airway collapses or narrows. You know, and a lot of things are blamed on aging, and we know that normal aging is very different than aging as a result of living the standard American diet, lifestyle, nutrient deficiencies, etc., lots of stress. So I'm not an expert in sleep apnea. Of course, would have you go and check things out, but there are a number of things we'll talk about in our what do you do to help people get better sleep. But there is actually a technique called the Botenko. I think it's Boteko, breathing method. And they teach people how to actually close the mouth during sleep. They actually tape it closed and use the nose, and then do some breathing exercises during the day. And I've known people to do this, and it can be really, really dramatic. So that's one of your resources to help people with sleep. Statistics? Well, over 18 million Americans suffer from it. That's huge. And an estimated 10 million remain undiagnosed. Now, you get diagnosed with sleep apnea and you get put on a sleep machine, a CPAP machine. It's not real fun. I mean, it's just not real fun. It's noisy. It's not great for the partner. So a lot of people want to avoid that. Over 50% are diagnosed in people over age 40. So most people, but still there's a significant number of people under the age of 40 that are having this issue. And it's really a matter of looking at underlying causes. Now, we don't do this for that approaches, right? We look at what are all the underlying things. So you're looking at their weight, you're looking at their alcohol consumption, you're looking at the position, you're looking at their breathing, you're looking at their parasympathetic versus sympathetic dominance. So those are all really important things. And there's a really good article there on the sleep apnea statistics. So 4 to 9% of middle-aged men suffer from it. That's a huge number. That's a huge number of people. And middle-aged, in their words, are considered anybody over age 40. I consider middle-aged anybody older than me. So I am not, I don't like to label, like, we're middle-aged, we're old, we're young. It's just really like age groups. So an over 40 crowd is 4 to 9% of men and 2 to 4% of women. So that's a huge amount of people. And the sleep apnea thing, you know, with these CPAP machines, it's a huge business. So we want to be able to look at what you can do naturally to help people restore balance. So restless legs can affect as many as 10% of people. And this is not a situation where you just have some cramping occasionally during the night or you have a Charlie horse or whatever. This is actually something where the legs are, they're shaking. They're in uncontrolled spasm. It can begin early and worsen with age. Pregnancy and hormonal changes can temporarily worsen. The good news is there are some nutrients and some natural approaches to it. There are drugs that they use to treat them, and they target dopamine receptors in the brain, which are linked to risk and reward, which is kind of interesting. The problem with taking these drugs is that they can aggravate gambling or compulsive sex addictions in some people. So, lovely, my legs don't twitch, but I'm going out looking for sex partners or gambling away my life savings. Lovely. I don't know. Not a good choice. And then what else? So, your symptoms, right? You've got the sensations of itching, tingling, crawling, pulling, cramping. It's like you just, it's involuntary movement. You know, they're not obviously twitching the way they are in the previous picture. That was a cartoon, but they're just not, you're not able to get up and move around. It's just like they can't control the movements, okay? The urge begins or gets worse during periods of rest or inactivity. So obviously it's going to get worse during sleep. But people with restless legs may be, you know, just sitting at work doing nothing and the legs start to twitch, or resting or getting a massage or other things like that. So that's why it's worse in the day and night. And some of the causes, well, abnormal dopamine signaling. So, and we know as we go through and learn more about neurotransmitters and balance and all that, that there are ways to optimize dopamine. And optimizing dopamine involves optimizing gut health, because a lot of dopamine is produced there. Optimizing amino acid nutrition. Optimizing the cofactors like vitamin B6 and magnesium and B12 and folate. So all of those things can be important in optimizing the dopamine. But in addition, there are other nutrient deficiencies that have been found to be related. So iron, folate, magnesium, B12. There's a gene variant that doubles a person's risk for developing restless leg. And it was discovered just a couple of years ago in 2011. It's called the BTBD9. And there's multiple SNPs of that are associated with less restless legs, with similar certainty as ApoE4 is associated with Alzheimer's. And ApoE4 is very highly associated with Alzheimer's. So almost most of the people with Alzheimer's have some of the 4 variant on the ApoE4. Okay, so the BT is very, very much a strong association. These other genes are not as strongly associated, but still associated. ME151, MAP2K5, RS3923809. That one doesn't have it. I haven't found a little shortcut associated with it. But, you know, you can always look these up. I'm not sure if these show on the 23andMe or in the raw data or in the MTHFR support report, but these are definitely associated. So if you're, you know, thinking you or somebody that you're working with has that tendency, that you can look into whether there's a genetic component. But again, genes are genes and epigenetics is king, right? Queen. Epigenetics controls most things. So you can control it, and you want to be looking at what's going on in the person's body. And a lot of times when we're working with people with these obscure disorders, we just go and, yeah, if we can give them Band-Aids, we give them Band-Aids when we can, while we're working on the underlying causes. But a lot of times these things clear up when you just get to the root and just start restoring balance. So we don't have to know exactly how to deal with restless legs sometimes. We can give them some temporary relief and then go to restoring balance in the body. In our next presentation, we're going to talk a lot more about how do you deal with sleep disorders? How do you help people to get better sleep?